Okay, so it's nice to have a chance to revisit this old subject. I'm going to, it's sort of divided into two halves. The first half is just going to be a little bit of the history as I recall it and as I've come to know it. You'll notice that we're just going to be starting in 1945. And I'll explain why on the next transparency, why it starts in 1945. And then the latter part of the talk will be, so that's sort of some general things. And I want to get to something specific in the latter part of the talk, which is specific and specifically about Octonians. And I will first of all, to do that, I first of all have to introduce some work that was done by the number of people that you see in green there in the middle, on essentially Lorentz harmonics, celestial spheres, and so on. And this is related to the kind of Penrose's idea and twisted transforms and so on. And then I will actually get to an application of some of those ideas to develop this twisted transform or twisted light transform for the Super-Young-Mills case. And out of that will come basically a very specific connection with the norm division algebras, RCHO. Okay, so first of all, let's get to the history part. I'm having a trouble moving this down to the next. My button was working. Oh, let me see if I can just activate it somehow. Oh, here we go. Good. So actually the history really begins, I think, in 1944-45, because there's a paper by Dirac in the Proceedings of the Royal Irish Academy. Of course, that was one of the famous members of that academy was Hamilton. So that may account for why the paper is in that particular journal. But also, of course, 44 was also wartime. So maybe they had 44-45, maybe they simply didn't publish it until the war was over. But in any case, he has a paper in that journal, and it doesn't cite anybody, and it has never been cited. In fact, I've never seen it. I've seen it cited only once in a paper, in a journal paper or a preprint, and that's because I told the authors about it. I actually learned about it myself from an obituary written by some Russian physicist of Dirac. And when I got hold of it, I was astounded actually to see what was in it. Let me just, it's a quick anecdote. I can preface this by saying I actually heard Dirac speak, I think it was in 1976, thereabouts, in MIT. It was introduced by Penrose. And what he said, largely he said in the talk, or what I remember of it, he says there were two topics in mathematics that he'd always been very interested in, but had never really been able to use in physics. And those two topics were quaternions and projective geometry. And it's precisely those two topics that he combined in this paper from 1944-45. It's also virtually unknown. But what he did was to point out that the Lorentz group, he didn't do it quite in this order, but essentially what he did was to point out that the Lorentz group in a six-dimensional Minkowski spacetime can be viewed as the special linear group of two tie two matrices over the quaternions. And essentially he did that by actually starting with an application of that group as a fractional linear transformations on the celestial force sphere. So he was in a force sphere in six dimensions, which is the quaternionic projective line. And of course, he was actually interested in Minkowski Lorentz transformations in four dimensions, because in those days, it would have been absurd to start discussing physics in six dimensions. And so this was by way of, he first of all introduced that, and then he tried to get down to four dimensions. And he did that essentially by saying that four-dimensional space-time would be embedded in this larger six-dimensional space-time. Of course, what happens is that the SL2H basically breaks down into an SL2C, which is then he discussed in this quaternionic language. That's, of course, acting by fractional linear transformations on the celestial two-sphere. There is an extra U1 which appears in this, and I put that in here in a different color because Dirac didn't mention it, but it'll turn out that somehow that always appears whenever you do, whenever you look at these things over the complex, when you look at the real complex quaternions, octonions, and you focus on the complex case, you always get this extra U1 factor coming up, as we'll see. So this was 20 years before Penrose, I think, and certainly 40 years before I started to think about it. So, some of these things in the six-dimensional context, which I'll come to in a moment or two. So essentially my introduction to this whole idea was when I went to Japan. I think it was in 82 or thereabouts. At that time, I went to give some lectures on supergravity in Kyoto University at the invitation of Taichiro Kubo. And while I was looking at some things in his room, I came across this dictionary of Japanese mathematics. It was an encyclopedia of Japanese mathematics, which was only in Japanese at that time. But it was the, but nevertheless, I leafed through it and I found some interesting tables, which I asked Taichiro to translate for me. And that's how we came across the idea that SL2H was the Lorentz, was isomorphic to the Lorentz group in six dimensions. And we sort of played around with that little idea and tried to relate it to supersymmetry. So, but the motivations for us essentially were the work that was going on signal models at the time, and to some extent, superspace formulations of super Yang-Mills theories. So we knew that, for example, there was certainly some connection from sigma models, because if you have n equals one sigma model, these are all in two dimensions at that time, and they were all parity preserving, so they really be n comma n. So for n equals one, real for n, Kähler for n equals two, hyper Kähler for n equals four. And I think there was no mention of n equals eight in those days, because it had to be flat. You couldn't have interactions. But in fact, if you look at the algebra of supersymmetry, that tells you actually the dimension still has to be, even though it's flat, it still has to be a multiple of eight. And in addition, at that time, there was a formulation of an extended supersymmetry. Ivanov had written a paper suggesting that somehow that should be, that he connected that with quaternions. So going from n equals one to n equals two meant going from complex numbers to quaternions. And we were looking at these things and we thought that you can make the whole thing, the commonality in all of them is seen by going to the maximum space-time dimension permitted by supersymmetry for a given number of supersymmetry charges. And then you see, pops out, is that particular, then the dimension, those dimensions for which you can have those maximal supersymmetries are always two plus dimension of K. And so this connection is, of course, is supported, you could say expected, from the fact that once you know that in those dimensions, namely three, four, six, of course, 10 dimensions we were not able to say much about, but in those cases, at least, you have the group SL2K. So we explored a little bit the properties of these spinners in those dimensions and suggested that it was two plus dimension K. Because there had been various other suggestions of other kinds of relationships and with other dimensions. So that's one of the striking sequences of groups that struck us actually looking at this table in this Japanese encyclopedia of mathematics. But of course, there's what about the D equals 10 case? Because that should somehow be related to octonion. So you would like the special linear group, if you could define it, in two by two matrices of the octonions, be somehow equal to spin 1-9. Now, if you just look at that, that doesn't look as though it's likely to work, because if you just check naively the number of generators you would have, for all the other cases, you would say, well, it should have four times the dimension K minus one. Basically, you put the determinant to one, real determinant to one, and work out how many generators. So that's the number you should have. But if you just put that in 4k equals 0, then you only get 31, which is clearly not the right answer. Should be 45. Now, that was taken up later by Sudbury, who did it in a much more sophisticated way. Well, he basically did something mathematical there, whereas we had not even attempted it. And so Sudbury was discussing it just for any orthogonal groups, but he was discussing just the algebra. But the group aspects of them were later elaborated by, I think the first paper on this is a little one known one by Tachibana in Maeda, that was already in 89, and the Monogon-Schrey. And there's a very relatively recent paper by Vieira on the group representation, octonionic representation of the group SL2O. In any case, what Sudbury noticed was that one of the problems you arise at from the naive perspective is that if you look at, for example, taking two transformations, if you linearize a set of transformations and then you get a commutator B with X and then you have A commutator with X, and you take it the other way around, you don't just get the commutator of A, B with X, because there's a failure of the Jacobi identity. What you get is an extra term, which is an element of G2. And so the idea is that since dimension of G2 has 14, then really you should add 14 to this count of the dimension of the algebra. And if you do that, then you get 45. I never quite understood where the extra parameters come from, because you'd have to provide extra parameters for this term. But in any case, let's call it the add 14 rule. If you do that, you get the right answer there. And there's some mathematical backing for that. So that's a striking sequence. But on the other hand, it was a striking sequence, but there was no real connection at this point to octonians. I mean, octonians didn't really get in except in this kind of suggestive way. I think the way that they first really entered in a more convincing way was in the context of super Young-Mills theories. Now, Brink and Schwartz and Shirk had already, in fact, back in 1976, constructed super Young-Mills theories in higher dimensions, but they'd considered the dimensions 2, 4, 6, and 10, not 3, 4, 6, and 10. And in fact, I think at the time that I was looking at this in Japan, I'm not even sure that I knew about Brink, Schwartz, and Shirk, because 76 was essentially when I finished my PhD. At that point, I didn't know about supersymmetry. So I just started straight in on supergravity. And I think I probably didn't even know about their paper, even much later on, 6 years later. But in any case, that was not an impetus in the original ideas about this. But things changed in 84, Green-Schwartz revolution, Strupesing revolution. And one of their papers, of course, was to find a Lorentz invariant, a covariant formulation for the superstring action. And they pointed out that works only in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions. Now it's 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions, not 2. But the point is that they found that exactly the same identity that you need to construct the super Young-Mills theory, which is an identity cubic you can view it as a cubic in commuting spinners. I'll just call it the cubic identity. So basically 2 was not maximal for that amount of supersymmetry, because they assumed basically 1, 1. So they could as well have discussed, Brink and Schwartz and Shirk could have already discussed 3, 4, 6, and 10, but they didn't do so. Green and Schwartz, that was for 3, 4, 6, and 10. And the first concrete connection to the octonians in the 10-dimensional case, I think, came from a paper by Sierra. It was a little bit of a throwaway remark, but he pointed out that in a formulation of the Jordan algebras of 3x3 matrices, in which basically you focus on the norm, it's the formulation due to McCrimmon. So he realized that one of the axioms of McCrimmon was essentially this cubic identity. And so effectively the Jordan identity for 3x3 Hermitian matrices must be equivalent to this cubic identity. And I think Schrey found more or less the same thing in 1994. But as I say, Sierra's comment was in fact very, a bit of a throwaway remark. It wasn't really noticed much. But then the next year, Jonathan Evans wrote a very nice paper explicitly on this point and showing that the cubic identity this cubic identity can be understood as essentially the Adam's trialities that are satisfied only for the norm division algebras. So it's an alternative way of understanding the norm division algebras. And what Evans did was to show that that alternative way of understanding them is in fact precisely equivalent to finding solutions of this cubic identity. So that provided a very explicit link to the Octonians. But I think even at that point, nobody had actually used the Octonians to construct any of these theories. I should also remark, mainly because it has absolutely nothing to do with this talk, that supersymmetry ends, at least as far as I know, that supersymmetry and the norm division algebras enter in various other ways. And one of them is via the magic square, if one starts to look at supergravity theories. So just as another anecdote here, when I got back from Japan and I'd been looking at all these norm division algebras, and I decided I'm going to put that aside and do something completely different. And it seemed that it would be good to look at the geometry associated with coupling five-dimensional supergravity to matter, because opposite my office was Eugène Cremer, who was an expert on five-dimensional supergravity. And so I got together with Sierra and we worked out a whole bunch of equations related to these couplings. We had them on the board and we're trying to understand what they meant. And Murat Ganaydin, and you just arrived in Paris, came through the door to see me. I'd met him previously at CERN and he came through to say hello. He took one look at the board and said, "Hey, you see, you're working on Jordan algebras." And so we said, "What? That's not what we thought." But it turned out that indeed we were, apparently, and we had again to get back into RCHO, the magic square, and somehow. I've always thought that should have a relation to all these other relations, but as far as I know, it doesn't. At any rate, let's move on now, because that, as I say, is just something which you has nothing, is not related to what I'm talking about today. Now, in Sudbury's paper, he was discussing essentially all these isometries, and particularly groups over the reals, complex quaternions, and Octonians, and for the orthogonal groups. But of course, that would also include the conformal groups. And actually, Kugo and I had also looked at the conformal groups, and we'd noticed that, yes, there were some connections. If you looked in six dimensions, there was clearly some quaternions behind spin 2-6, but it all looked a bit messier in terms of the notation and so on. It didn't look quite so pleasing on the page. But Sudbury introduced a new notation, because he pointed out essentially that if you look at the symplectic groups, normally in mathematics, they're just defined as the group preserving an antisymmetric matrix. Even if you look over the complex numbers, you still keep with an antisymmetric matrix. Now, in the cases, if you're looking at symmetric forms, the natural generalization of a symmetric form over the reals is not a symmetric form over the complex numbers, but a Hermitian form over the complex numbers. And at least in the context of physics, that's usually the case. That's usually the natural thing to do. So he said, well, the natural thing to consider is not an antisymmetric matrix over the complex numbers, but a quadratic form over the complex numbers. And more generally, let's consider skew Hermitian quadratic forms over reals, complex quaternions, and Octonians. Now, if you do that, and his notation for that was a bit of dagger. Now, if you do that, it does now look very pleasing to the eye again, because actually, of course, the symplectic group of 4 over the complex numbers, well, that's, of course, now this is the unitary, standard unitary thing, but that's a well-known U4-4. But that's just the four-dimensional conformal group, basically because the difference between Hermitian and anti-Hermitian over the complex numbers is just multiplying by I. So if you're looking, you're trying to preserve a skew Hermitian, that's the same as preserving Hermitian, essentially. In six-dimensional cases, SP4 over the quaternions is spin 2-6. So essentially, we've essentially replaced orthogonal groups by symplectic groups. And then the 10-dimensional case is one that Sudbury discussed in much more detail later as the conformal group. And notice that, again, there's a U1 factor that appears in the 4-dimensional case. And notice that also except for the Octonian case, if you work out the dimension of these groups, you just get, by looking at just at the matrices, number of independent components, you just get 6-dimension K plus 4. But that's, if you apply that to the Octonians, that's 6 times 8 plus 4, which is 52, which is not the right number. But if you just add 14, you get 66, which is the right number, the add 14 rule. Of course, you can apply the same kind of logic to rotation subgroups. Sudbury didn't do this, but if you just simply apply, you can just view a unitary group as an SO dagger group. And you can apply that to the rotation groups in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions. And again, you get a nice looking sequence. So for example, in 6 dimensions, the rotation group in 6 dimensions is just SO dagger 2 over the quaternions, which is SP2, which is spin 5. And then you can also look at the Octonionic case. And I suppose Sudbury was looking at that one too. And notice again that there's a U1 factor that always appears in the 4-dimensional case. So, and again, of course, if you look at the dimensions of these things, then naively you come to the conclusion that the dimension of those groups would be 3 times the dimension of K minus 2. If you add that all up, you get the wrong number. But if you add 14, you get the wrong number for the Octonians. But if you add 14, you get 36, which is the dimension of spin 9. So that works again. Now, as part of this, survey of some of these ideas, just I'd like to make a digression now just into string end theory, because I've been applying this, basically looking at these kind of sequences in the context of space-time dimensions of 3, 4, 6, and 10. But of course, you can also apply that instead of the space-time, instead of it being a space-time dimension, you can also think of it as a world volume dimension. So in the context of brains, if you look at the planar static M2, D3, M5 brains of string M theory, which are picked out for a special in various ways. One of them is that they yield maximally supersymmetric field theories with the conformal theories on a Minkowski world volume of dimension 3, 4, and 6. And you can include 10, actually, if you encounter, you can think of if you take the Harava-Witten boundary of 11-dimensional spacetime, which is a 10-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, on which because of the necessity to cancel some anomalies, you get an E8 gauge theory, which in itself indicates that quaternions should play a role in some way. So if you consider that as a 9-brain, you can include that as well. And indeed, you can. It's for many purposes. Many other purposes. You can actually think of it as an M9, as a 9-brain. So let's do that. Now, of course, one of the reasons that these are particular brains are special is essentially because their field theories can be conformal invariant. At least the free field theories are conformal invariant. And if you view them as sources for a corresponding supergravity solution, then near the horizon, you get this ADS cross S type of geometry. And then you can look at the sequences of superisometry groups. And if you do that, and so this was done in a relatively recent paper, if you look at that, then you get indeed another nice sequence, the OSP group for the 3-dimension. And in the 4-dimensional case, which is the unitary again, but that's the same as OSP dagger. And then the 6-dimensional case, it's again OSP dagger 2. And of course, what happens is that the numbers on the right are 4 always, but OSP, basically the O part, the first role is giving you the number of supersymmetries, but counted as independent spinners. But of course, since the dimension of the spinner is increasing at the same time, in order to keep the number of supersymmetries at 32, you have to decrease that number from 8 to 4 to 2. And then if you would go to the next one in the sequence to 10, you would say, well, we should have some kind of OSP Dagger 1/4 over the Octonians. Can that play the same role? Now, strangely enough, there is a paper, in fact, in 1984, which I literally didn't know about until 2017, by Hasibets and Lukiewski, who tried to attempt to interpret precisely this group. I mean, group is, I should put in some scare quotes, but they actually they discuss mostly the algebra, as a D equals 11 to sitter like algebra. So I don't know, I personally haven't been able to make much sense of their paper, but there it is. Okay, so that's a little bit of the history towards this connection between the dimension of space-time and the norm division algebras. Now, just let's look at put supersymmetry aside just for the moment, and just say, well, how can you, well, everything I've discussed up to now would be, okay, there are these norm division algebras which play some role, but if they really are important, surely we'd be able to construct the theories in terms of these division algebras. Shouldn't we be able to do that? Well, let's see how far you can get on that. The first thing you would like to know is, well, what about a point in space-time? How can you write that as in terms of a real complex, in terms of real complex quaternions or octonions? Well, of course, that's well known. If you look at a 2x2 Hermitian matrix over the real complex quaternions or octonions, that's equivalent to a point in a Minkowski space-time at dimension 3, 4, 6, and 10. And the parametrization is basically this light-like parametrization, where this bold-faced X is the transverse space dimension just an element of this norm division algebra. And you have a natural transformation, Lorentz transformations on that, which acts in this particular way. So L is an element of SL2K, and you define it by this relation here. It's not actually the determinant of L, because that's not defined generally over R. It's defined for the reals and complex numbers, but not for the quaternions or the octonions. But it's defined if you take LL dagger, then that's Hermitian. So then the determinant is defined over the quaternions, and even for the octonions, provide they're only 2x2 or 3x3 matrices, which is the case here, of course, 2x2. So that's defined, that defines that group, and you get an action from L from the left and L dagger from the right. And that's a vector. Now, if you want a covector, then basically you get a different transformation. And if you wanted, you might, we're essentially going from one to the other. It's like we would say, you know, pushing an index up or down. And if you want to know how that works, if you've written them in this 2x2 notation, then it's the same as trace reversal, as pointed out by Schrey. So if Hermitian M is a vector, then if you remove the trace, remember, so if I take the trace of M tilde, I get trace of M minus twice the trace of M, so it becomes minus the trace of M. So they have opposite traces. Then that's a covector. And if you take covector of a covector, you get back to a vector. And if you take the product of a vector with a covector, you actually get the determinant times the identity. So those are all useful relations in trying to write down things work directly with these matrices. So in the context of particle mechanics, it's actually fairly straightforward to do that. You can really write things down in those dimensions using these matrices. So for example, a particle of mass m in 3, 4, 6, and 10, it can be simply written like in this way, relativistic particle reparametrization invariant. So you simply have a mass shell condition. And det p is essentially proportional to p squared. Actually, probably I should have det p as m squared to some power, in fact, because for the six-dimensional case, it would be m squared all squared, I think. But anyway, minor mistake there. So in the case, of course, if you want to, now the whole point here, in some sense, is the connection with supersymmetry. So if you wanted to get supersymmetry into it, what you have to do, so the standard way of doing this, as Castle pointed out by Castle, Buoni, Brink, and Schwartz, is you simply replace dx by a Lorentz invariant form, dx is theta d theta, et cetera, and that is left invariant under Lorentz transformations. excuse me, it's and not Lorentz, it's left invariant under under supersymmetry transformation. In fact, super translations, not under a Lorentz transformation, of course, but it transforms just as in the same way as a vector. And you have to do that, of course, for a Grassmann-Odd SL2K spinner. So now a spinner will be just two components, but each component is an element of K. So for example, over the Octonians, that's 16 real components altogether, which is indeed the number of components of a minimal chiral spinner in 10 dimensions. Now, of course, this is rather straightforward if it's just real and complex numbers. The quaternionic case is a bit more complicated, but actually was written down for the superparticle in a paper of 1988 by Kimura and Oda. And in fact, they then went on with Nakamura to do the same thing for the octonions. So they actually write the superparticle explicitly using octonions. That appears in their paper of 1988. And I think also in Schrader it later in 1994. And one of the nice things about Schrader's paper is he found a simple presentation of the cubic identity, which is discussed further in Baez and Huerta. And I think it's called the, they call it, maybe Schrader also called it the psi-cubed identity or something like that. Anyway, we'll be using this cubic identity at various points later on. Because it's, I'm going to be coming shortly to coming back to the Maxwell, to the Yang-Mills case in a moment, or rather the Maxwell. So let's, but we're carrying on here with just the particle. So one thing you might want to do for the particle is to, if I go back here, is in the massless case, at any rate, you get the determinant of P is equal to zero. So one thing you might want to do is to solve that. Now, there's the nice way of solving it in terms of a SL2K spinner, because if, so determinant of P has to be zero. So if you write P out as UU dagger as in terms of spinners, then you'd need UU dagger plus other similar terms. You need at least two such terms to get a non-zero determinant. If you just have one, then essentially it's singular, and so determinant is equal to zero. So you can solve the constraint, the Machel constraint in this case, simply in terms of a single spinner. Now, whereas U, on the other hand, of course, you realize that U has basically its number of components is two times the dimension of the algebra K, whereas the null vector P has only D minus one is dim K plus one. So now that more or less coincides essentially in three dimensions, but in higher in the other dimensions, it doesn't. There are more components of U than appear in P. And so there's a gauge transformation. And that gauge transformation is in fact right multiplication by a unit norm element of K. So actually that gives you a Z2 group in three dimensions, but then otherwise you get U1 SU2. And then if you go to the octonionic case, you get O7. S7 isn't a group, or is it? Well, according to Sonius, it's a soft group. And Sewell wrote another paper sort of exploring these kinds of things. You get structure constants, which are not strictly constant, but vary where you are on the seven sphere. At any rate, I leave that there for the moment, but we're going to come back to similar issues in a moment. Let me just point out here, of course, if you have a massive particle, then essentially you, instead of having a single spinner U, you have a pair of them, so it's U, or you just write it's U dagger, where you have an invertible matrix U. And now the gauge invariance is just essentially you have Lorentz from the left and acting from the right, you have these rotation groups. Okay, so now I want to come back to the point of looking at massless particles. And thinking about massless particles, one is led to the idea of the celestial sphere, because that's essentially the celestial sphere is, as the name suggests, you have light rays coming from any direction in space. And that's just the two sphere you see, the stars essentially appear as if they're on this celestial sphere. So the idea is to, now there are various ways to do this, but if what we want to do, what we're aiming to do here is to find a Lorentz invariant way of integrating quantities over the celestial sphere. And the most systematic way of doing that is to think of these celestial spheres as coset spaces of the Lorentz group, which in this case is SL2K. But you can do this, you can start that procedure for any space-time dimension. So the idea is you take the Lorentz algebra, spin 1, d minus 1, and you decompose it with respect to the transverse rotation group. Essentially, this is the isotropy group of a light-like vector. And so that preserves the isotropy group preserves a, so that's a transverse rotations, but there's also a SO11 factor. But if you, there's a decomposition of the group itself, which breaks into the weights of the various generators under SO11. So there's a bunch that have negative weight. That's actually a d minus two vector. They're both d minus two vectors. One has negative weight and one has positive weight. And they're essentially raising lowering operators for this SO11 weight. And if you take just the algebra of H0 and the positive weights, then that generates a maximal subalgebra, the maximal parabolic, or Borel. Well, I think Borel isn't strictly correct, but in any case, sometimes called Borel subgroup of this Lorentz group. And so if you take the coset space, if you basically divide out the Lorentz group by that subgroup, you get a compact space of dimension which is exactly the right dimension. It's that dimension, dimension of K. So it's a sphere. So it's a d minus two dimensional sphere, and that's the coset space. And this idea was developed in 91 by Galperin, Howe, and Stell. And so at the level of the group, of course, so you divide out by the group. So that's this group here, and then it's a semi-direct product with this H plus part. And the point is that now that's an in general dimension, but in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions, again, so it's special because you can write an element of the Lorentz group as a pair of spinners, as just, rather similar to what we've been doing for the moment. And you can just think of it for the moment as these, again, two component spinners over real complex quaternions and octonions. Now, I'm just going to, the octonionic case, you could say, wait a minute, does it work for the octonions? But let's just put aside those issues for the octonions for the moment, just to get the idea. In fact, I'll be doing something a little bit different when we come to the octonions later on. but that's the basic idea. And so you have U plus U minus, which gives you L dagger minus one is some other spinners, plus or minus the index down means it has negative weight now, the opposite to the U's. And so the positive weight ones are U plus and V minus, and the others all have negative weight. Now, the point is here is that if you're trying to construct, now, the point is that the celestial sphere, essentially you're dividing out by all of the parameters contained in this group. So you don't want to have, you can't parameterize the celestial sphere with any spinner which has a non-zero transformation under this H plus part. Now, the only ones which are inert under H plus are precisely the spinners of positive weight. So those are the only ones you can use. And what you need to do now is you'd like to construct some kind of weight. So you start by looking at one forms. You need, of course, a d minus two form ultimately, but let's construct them from some one forms. And you'd like them to be inert under this subgroup. For example, what about you'd like it to be H plus inert. And so you must use these positive weight ones, but you'd also like it to be invariant under the SOD minus two as well. Well, you can do that by, because of this identity here, you can do that by constructing this one form W plus plus, which as you see has weight. Oh, that dagger should be a plus, not a, oh no, the minus is down below, that's correct. So that has weight two. Now you cannot construct a measure, so that actually is invariant under the whole Borel subgroup except for the weight. And you cannot find one of non-zero weight, of zero weight, because you can only use things which have positive weight. So that's really the best you can do. Now you have to multiply some number of them together to get a measure on the D minus two sphere. And so you get some kind of measure on the celestial sphere this way. And the point is it has dimension. If you work it out, simply has, you see this has dimension, this is weight two. So the weight on the celestial two, celestial sphere in dimension D dimensions will be two dim K. So in other words, the measure isn't completely invariant, but of course, if you integrate it over something which has a weight which cancels the weight of the measure, then you get an invariant. So the integrand has to have the weight of minus dimension K. And some of these constructions of integrations were mentioned, were worked out by Del, Galper, and Sokcher in a paper of 92. And there's a simplification that occurs in 3 and 4 dimensions, because then these spinners U plus and V minus, they're actually an equivalent Lorentz representation. So you can do it without ever thinking about the Vs. Now in the 6 and 10 dimensions, that's not the case, because the U's will have positive chirality and the V's will have negative chirality, and you can't go from one to the other. They're inequivalent Lorentz representations. So you need to do something a little bit different in the 6 and 10 cases. And that's one of the complications that prevented sort of progress prior to this work. Now, I should just mention before going on here that you can see already from this that the celestial spheres are projective lines, because this Borel subgroup acts on U plus as if I'm now, well, because it's invariant under U H plus, but so the only thing left is the SOD minus two, which is essentially action by an element of K of unit norm, but you're also multiplying by just some positive element. So essentially you get multiplication by right multiplication by a non-zero element of K. So that's how this acts. And you're basically dividing out by that. So that tells us that the celestial sphere SL2K over HB is actually the projective line KP1. And a well-known fact, of course. So now let's do this. So I want to come back and use this to do this, but let's just look, let's sort of go back, pretend I hadn't told you any of that now. And you're just looking at the simplest case. You're looking at the three-dimensional wave equation, and you're wondering how can I solve this equation? Well, you say, let's see, I do a Fourier transform. So I write phi of x is e to the I p dot x, some function of p. And well, if I put in a delta p squared there, then automatically that will solve the wave equation, because I take box on this, I'll get a p squared, but that's zero because of delta p squared. Well, I mean, the point is that p squared is equal to zero, but the only contribution is, in fact, from the point where p squared is equal. It's the only contribution is from where p squared is equal to zero, therefore the integral is zero. Okay, you can simply write p out and solve for p zero and write it in this way. And now what we can do is let's set p as some factor times u bar plus gamma u plus. Now, the reason I'm not writing this as p is u bar u gamma u, basically, by putting in the omega factor, is because I want p to be inert under, I want p is inert, p didn't, we didn't know about this SO11 weight when you write down the momentum. So we would like the omega factor to cancel out the weight of the u, so actually it has to have negative weight too. So I put that omega in there and I just calculate dp1 wedge dp2 and I get this. Because you notice that p0 is directly related to u transpose u. And so I get this relation here, and then I realize, I have my measure here. That's a d mu. That's my measure d mu. And then this factor here is just my integrand. And what's it depend on? Well, notice that when I put in a p dot x here, I'm contracting with the p, which is now this. I'm contracting an x. So I get an omega, and then x contracted with this. So here it is. I'm using Feynman's notation x slash. I'm just calling that u plus x plus plus. So what I get here is e to the I omega x plus plus. This is the general p, but p depends on basically omega and u plus. And of course, then I get an x plus plus dependence through there. So if I do this integral, and you can easily see by construction that when I scale under this scaling of u, omega scales as minus two. And so this in fact scales as minus two. It has the correct weight to be an integrand to give you, this has weight two, it's an integrand of weight minus two. Hence you get something invariant. That's a solution. And you can check that it's a solution because if you take box of this, you bring down each time you get a derivative with respect to x plus plus, because x only appears through this quantity here. That gives you a u dagger, u plus gamma u. Maybe there's a bar there missing. Well, that square is null because that's a null vector. So now I'm using the fact that u bar gamma u is null. That's basically the three-dimensional case of what I said before, that this big u plus u dagger u has a unit zero determinant. So now that's a straightforward way of solving the three-dimensional equation, and you see that you basically get it in precisely the form that we've been heading towards previously. Let's do the same for four dimensions. Well, now if you look for a positive energy solution to the wave equation, you can do exactly the same, and you now end up with 5x is d mu. Now the measure d mu is now something which has weight minus four, because you have to, this is complex, you have to get it to be real, so you have to take the complex conjugate. So now you get a two form, which you of course need, because you are integrating over S2. And again, it depends on this x plus plus. X plus plus now is defined in the analogous way, and of course over the u plus, which are now complex two component Weyl spinners. And the integrand also has weight minus four, which of course it must. Now you can, and so it's, if I write it out in terms of the components, if I just define a complex number, which is u2 over u1, and remember that's essentially a coordinate on the celestial sphere, which is the Riemann sphere now. Then this measure is just simply a measure of the Riemann sphere times something which has zero weight, because I've absorbed this into the definition here of z. This gets absorbed into the little f. So I get a capital F, which now this has zero weight. So now you have basically this integral over the Riemann sphere of something which has zero weight. And the point is that S2 is a symplectic manifold. So you can now use this Duisseman-Heckmann theorem. You can localize all contributions to points on S2. And then you can express those integrals. You can express those contributions from points on S2 as contour integrals around those points on the celestial sphere. And if you do that, you now have Penrose's twister transform solution. And so in other words, you can view the Penrose's twister transform idea as basically in two steps. One step is what I've described previously, which goes through, in fact, for reals, complex Bertonians and Octonians. And well, actually, I should say it's really three steps, isn't it? Because the second step is isolating it to contributions on a symplectic manifold, which S2 is, S1 isn't. But of course, S4 and S8 are. At least I think they are. In principle, you could do that step also, but the next step, of course, contour integrals. Then you need the whole paraphernalia of complex analysis. At least I presume you do. Okay, but now what I'm interested in, I want to go back to put in the supersymmetry here. So let's try and solve the 3D Maxwell equations. Now they're superfield equations, and there's a simple superfield equation. I'm not going to write down the superspace stuff, but I just give you the commutator of anti-commutator of covariant derivatives. Contains all the same information. You solve it in exactly the same way. Now I'm doing Maxwell. So basically I'm not considering, this is not a scalar. It's a spinner, so I have to put in one of these spinners here. Fine, now I get something which is essentially a world-line superfield, has something which I can interpret as time, and then you get some extra anti-commuting variables, which are just obtained just by contraction with the U's. So, and now what you find, and of course this has to have world-line weight three. If you just look at this, work it out, you get this term here, and that's equal to zero because the user commuting, excuse me, but I'm contracting with an epsilon alpha beta. So it works, you've solved the equation. Let's move on to four-dimensional supermaxima. Okay, you have exactly the same equation, but now it's for anti-commuting complex Weyl spinner superfield. So you can do exactly the same thing. Now the only difference is that, X plus plus is again that complex defined as we did it before. But then theta plus is now, you get a theta plus and you get a theta bar plus, of course. And of course, I should have put in here this, and there should be a comma there, that's a U plus as well. But so now it's an N equals two world line superfield. Now it has to have weight minus five. However, it's now constrained. The point is there's a constraint, which is this, I should have said, excuse me, I actually missed a point here. This has to be a complex Weyl spinner chiral superfield. Excuse me, otherwise it's not the right equation. So actually what you must impose is a chirality condition on this superfield, which means that this has to be zero. But you put that through here, and you see by looking at this that actually you need a corresponding chirality constraint on the world line, N equals two world line superfield, in order to get a solution of the 4D Maxwell equations. Yeah, I should have put chiral up there. Okay, so let's go on now, because let's look at the six-dimensional case. Now, in principle, you could do the whole thing here over the quaternions, but that gets more complicated for the 10-dimensional case. And even for the six-dimensional case, it's simpler, really, to use the fact that SL2H is isomorphic to SU star 4, which is basically a double cover of SO15. And so you're essentially replacing these two-component spinners by four-component chiral symplectic spinners, and that which means that they have an additional SU2 index on them. And in fact, separate SU2 indices. There's another index here, A equals 1 to 2, and another index there. So there are now two SU2 factors, which of course are the automorphisms of the quaternions.
Pardon me, Paul, can I ask a question?
Yep.
What is SU star for? Sir, what is the star there?
Oh, well, star, I forget the precise definition in terms of quaternions. It's a quaternionic realization of the group. So it involves the quaternions.
Of the group SU4.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, it's...
Okay,
it's
so it's basically, I should basically read SU4 there, but there's some...
Yeah,
there's some
that's right.
Okay, thank you.
You can read it as spin 1-5, actually. So it's spin 1-5.
The double cover, yeah.
But it's nice because if you know that the point is that the construction that gives you S star 4 is a quaternionic construction. So it's nice to think of it like
okay,
that.
Okay, it's like a quaternionic.
Yeah, it's explained in that book by Gilmore. I mean, as I remember where I read about that first of all.
Okay, thank you.
So you now for these four component spinners. Now, so the 60 Maxwell chiral spinner superfield now isn't it's an anti chiral super spinner. Field and it's again satisfies a relation here plus another one. So there's this condition and this is like the chirality condition again. So you can solve the first equation by simply writing this down as now I have to use this V's because I have to use an anti-chiral spinner. And you see now this thing gets an SU2 index on it, but there's also an index here. So they're really three SU2s going into the game here. There's the two A's, but there's the I index here, the so-called Pauli-Gaussier SU2. Really the triality of the three SU2s. And so you see there are basically four components of this world line superfield, but also what is theta plus? It actually has component IA, four of them as well. So you now have an SU2 cross SU2 vector N equals four world line superfield. Weight minus nine. And you want to solve I can't read my own slide on here because this is right, yes. So we want to solve the other superspace constraint. But if you work out what that implies, you discover that it implies this constraint on the world line superfield. And now there are four components of psi, and there are four supercovariant derivatives. So you can actually write them in terms of, you can write them basically in terms of quaternions. Here I've done it in terms of just triplets of Pauli matrices, because basically the way you go from just using the Pauli, because that's essentially going from quaternions to this SU star four is really like realizing the quaternions as Pauli matrices. If you rewrite that in terms of octonions, then you discover that these condition two prime actually boils down to this condition here, which is a generalization of the, you see, this is a triplet of conditions. If you have only a single complex, if you have only a single imaginary unit I, then of course this is just the chirality condition for a complex superfield of, you know, n equals two complex superfield. And so this is the way you generalize that to the quaternions. Now, you'll be glad to hear that I'm nearing the end now, because basically what I want to do, we want to do is next go next to the 10-dimensional case. I first of all actually have to discuss some preliminaries. So basically, as in the six-dimensional case there, what I'm going to do is to not use those octonionic spinners, but essentially use the fact that it's spin 1d minus 1. And you can write an element of the Lorentz group in this case as L alpha A. Now, the point here is that you need, if to write another, you see A alpha has 16 components. Now we have 16 component spinners. So if you write it as U plus U minus, each of those has to be an eightplet. And in fact, you take it to be basically the spinner representation of the root of the SO8, the spin 8 transverse rotation group, and that's the conjugate spinner. And then similarly for the L to the minus 1, they're real, so you take transpose. So you basically separate it into two spin 8 eightplets of opposite chirality. They also have opposite SO1 weight. And you basically go through the same construction as before. You can only use the positive weight spinners. And to cut a long story short, you get yourself your measure that way. Now, then you're looking to solve some sort of massless wave equation. And in order to do that, it's essential that the 10 vector U plus A gamma U plus A is null. Now, that's summed on A. Now, we know that if you just take a single U, U gamma U in 10 dimensions, that is going to be a null 10 vector. That's basically the point I'd said before. Like if you write momentum as U dagger U over the quaternionic, for quaternionic spinners, that essentially has determinant zero. So therefore P squared is zero, so it's null. But this is certainly not null in general. But the point is that these spinners, because of the whole construction, because this has to be an element of spin 1,9, they're actually constrained, and they're constrained by a relation which is given by this. And so as a result of this relation here, constraint, in fact, even if you sum on those indices, you still get a null 10 vector. Okay, now using that fact, and then we can move on. We can solve the 10-dimensional super Maxwell. So again, there are two equations you have to solve. One is this one here, which it basically gives you that's what's sort of containing the dynamics. And there's another one here too, which is essentially putting some constraints. Now you can solve, so if you only put this, of course in 10 dimensions, you can't really separate out the constraints and dynamical and non-dynamical ones. But anyway, so that's roughly the idea. Then you can solve the first one exactly as before in the same way. But now what happens, of course, you see your world line superfield is now an eightplet of them, and your anti-commuting variable, so your world line superspace also has eight fermions. So you have an eightplet of n equals eight world line superfields. And to cut a long story short, you can rewrite the condition you get on psi in exactly the same way, but involving a lot more work. You can rewrite it basically, but you can introduce supercovariant derivative, octonionic supercovariant derivatives, and you can introduce an octonionic valued superfield. And you can rewrite these condition two 2 prime, really, I should say now. Didn't I get 2 prime somewhere? I thought I had a slide where I had 2 prime on it. But I think that maybe, actually, I'm not, it's when I have, yeah, I should tell, I'm actually unable to move my slides when somebody is trying to be removed from or taken. There's, I accept some slide missing here, but I don't have 2 prime. Anyway, it's here it is, I'm there. It's imposed by, basically you get this condition here, and that's an Ochtonionic analog of the n equals 2 chirality condition. So the upshot is that if you're looking at solving the super Maxwell equations over the real, in the 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions, there's an explicit connection to the real complex Ochtonians or Ochtonians through this twist-like transform. Now, the fact that you might have thought, well, isn't that a bit surprising, because we needed the cubic identity previously for the Yang-Mills. When you put in the interactions, then you need the cubic identity to show you've got supersymmetry. But actually, as Jonathan Evans points out in his paper, it's a bit of a throwaway remark, but he points out that actually you already need this cubic identity before you look at the interactions, because the supersymmetry algebra will not close in the 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions, even for the Maxwell case, unless you have that cubic identity is satisfied. So we actually already knew from that these norm division algebras had to play a role already in the Maxwell case. And you can see that the way that they appear in the superspace formulation, what happens is, in some sense, you forced the algebra to work. And since you're forcing the algebra to work, that means that somehow the norm division algebras must enter into the calculation in another way. And this is how they enter into the calculation. They enter into it by a condition, which is essentially the K-chirality condition. Okay, that gets to basically where I wanted to be. At the end of this talk, what I wanted to tell you, I'm just move on to the last transparency, which is just, I was going to sort of try and sum it up, but in the end, when I was trying to write this transparency, I just had some final thoughts. So I thought, let me put those down. So basically, you can see that to some extent, I've discussed Yang-Mills and field theories, but I've also discussed superparticles. And the two are, of course, related by this twister-like transform. I've actually came looking at essentially world-line superfields from the point starting from the field theory, the free field equations, trying to solve them. But you can go back the other way. You can try to start from world-line superfield, a superparticle, quantize, and sort of derive the field equations. And I think there should be some sort of two-way street on this, but there's only a very little that's known about that. But to some extent, some aspects of that were done in this one of those other papers by Del Duc and company that I mentioned. But in any case, the point is you have superparticle in target space 2 plus target space 2 plus k dimensions. The number of world-line supersymmetry charges is the dimension of k. That's 1, 2, 4, and 8. But the number of Suzy charges of the field theory is actually twice that. Because if you start thinking about just already in 3 dimensions, a spinner has 2 components. So you have to multiply by 2. So actually, it's 2 times the dimension of k. But those field theories, right, describe fluctuations of some of them, those field theories, on BPS brains of world volume dimensions of precisely 2 plus dimension k, but now interpreted as a world volume. And those are sources in supergravity theories, which the number of supersymmetry charges is twice as big, because they are, after all, BPS brains break half the supersymmetry. So we go from a particle to some field theory to supergravity, which you can view maybe as effective theories for string, M theory, et cetera. And in each case, we're doubling the number of supersymmetries from 1, 2, 4, 8 to 2, 4, 8, 16, to 4, well, anyway, double that. So at k equals 0, then for the Ochtonionic case, you then get 32 supersymmetry charges. So that perhaps is a way forward to getting Ochtonions into string M theory, and then ultimately, as a way of getting the Ochtonions into whatever you get from those theories in the higher dimensions by compactification down to the standard model. As you can see from this talk, I have interpreted and in the title of the workshop, Hamiltonians and the Standard Model. I've interpreted that "and" as a union and not as an intersection. But of course, one would like there to be an intersection. And this is the best I can do for a possible intersection. So I thought I should end on something that would even give some kind of optimism for an intersection with what I'm sure other people will talk about on the Standard Model, which will have apparently no relation to any of this stuff. But maybe at the end of the day, it will have a relation. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you. And I've just gone a little bit over time, I think.
Great. Thank you very much for the very nice talk. There were some questions in the chat. I think John Huerta had a question. John, do you want to ask it yourself or you want me to read it?
Sure, I can ask it. My question was, are any of these OSP supergroups that you, there were the super isometry groups of certain spaces, are any of them super conformal symmetry groups, I think?
Well, yeah, I mean, they are. I was raising them actually as in the context of basically anti de Sitter, you know, but of course that's the same as super conformal in one dimension lower. So yes, in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions, they are really super conformal. Well, it was up here, wasn't it? Yes. Yeah, I could have just said super conformal and avoided the, but I wanted to do it. Well, I wanted to do it this way because this was the way actually, you know, that's how I discovered some of this stuff here. I mean, that's how I came across this article by Hasiel Lukiewski. It's also how we came about with my co-authors here. That's how we kind of came about this thing. But yes, of course, you could think of it just as well. They're connected, ADS, CFT. So, I mean, it's the same, right? But I just wanted to make the presentation in this way that gave some more optimism towards a connection between two string and M theory.
But also about those groups, are they, can you think of the ADS cross S geometries as being homogeneous spaces for these?
You can give an explicit, in fact, what we did in the paper was essentially to write down an explicit formulation of the superparticle, in fact, in twister type variables. So it ends up, and so it's literally everything is written in terms of quaternions, you know, real complex numbers or quaternions for these particular cases. And it's a very simple action, which these symmetries are manifest, basically. It's essentially the fundamental representation of these groups, you know, the supergroups are the variables of the superparticle in a twister-like formulation. Right. So all those symmetries are completely manifest once you do it in this way. So I think it was something like it had twister-like or twister type in the title. I forget the title of the paper, but something like that. But yeah, we did that. Now, beyond that, we didn't do anything beyond that. But I think that does to some extent answer your question, because the variables are precisely, you know, there's a linear action of these groups on the variables of the model. So it's simply manifestly invariant under these groups. And whereas we started with the superparticle in the ADS cross S background. Written in terms of X's and P's, but not in a flat background, but in this ADS cross S background. And starting with that, then sort of introducing some, you know, solving for P's and so on, in the way I was describing, introducing the other variables, you get exactly, basically, everything is determined in terms of a fundamental representation of one of these groups. And so, of course, we didn't do the octonionic case, but we were, of course, interested, what could we do and what would it mean? But one would have to make sense of. I should say that the way that this paper of Hasiewicz and Lukiewski goes about is at some point they use this idea that S7 is a soft group, and so it's in the same spirit as that kind of stuff. But whether or not that helps, I don't know.
There also was a comment from Leon. Leon, do you want to elaborate on your comment?
Sorry, say again?
There was a comment from Levon Borstein in the chat.
Oh, if he's oh, sorry, in the chat. Sorry, I don't see a chat. I mean...
Leon, are you still here? Do you want to elaborate on it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, fine. What is the comment?
Well...
Can I... Maybe if I... I've got full screen. If I don't have full screen, maybe I get comments. I don't know.
It looks like he has left, I think.
He has left. Okay. Then it's...
Yeah, he and I were chatting a bit. He said that he had to run and...
Childcare. Well, yeah, I went a few minutes.
Maybe only himself can make sense of this comment. So we would need him to explain what his comment meant. Anyway, I also have one question.
Yeah.
You didn't mention hope vibrations, right? For any of the k's, any of the division algebras, there is a corresponding hope vibration.
Yeah.
Their basis are celestial spheres.
Yeah. So,
do you have any comments on this? Do they fit into the story? Do they play any role?
I don't have any comments, but I'm pretty sure that they did enter in, but maybe not in an essential way, but they did enter into the stuff that I'm telling you here about some, I mean, this paper here, Galper and Howe and Stell and so on, I think they did enter into that, but not in an essential way. I mean, and some of these other papers, yeah, that played a role, but I don't think it ever played, as a fact, but it didn't play an essential role, as far as I'm aware. Yeah. I think there have been other papers. I mean, there are lots of other papers, of course, on some of these stuff. I mean, which have started from trying to make something out of that. I mean, there's a certain amount, there's quite a lot about, I think, about looking for kind of instanton type solutions of Yang-Mills theories, which in various dimensions, you know, the octonionic instantons and so on. Mm-hmm. And I think that they use that idea in a much more...
the basis of the Hopf vibrations, the dimension.
Yeah, they use that as...
2S4, S8.
That's right. So
the celestial spheres in the constructions that you talked about.
Yeah. I don't remember now, but my recollection is it wasn't essential to this discussion here. But it does come, but I know it enters into this solving Yang-Mills, which I've also looked at a little bit in the past. I don't know how, but maybe supersymmetry actually comes into that too. Probably does actually, because I mean, all of these kind of instanton type things are kind of closely connected to supersymmetry. So I suspect that that's another way of getting some of these dimensions reading in. But in that context, I think it would be much more important, yeah.
Hoseki has a comment in the chat. Hoseki, do you want to say it loud?
Yeah, can I read the chat somewhere? I'm not sure how to do that.
You need to press the chat button at the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, so all I wanted to say was that in the case of... In precisely the spinor representations that Paul just talked about, if you square the spinor to get a vector, you can make it such that this vector is null.
Yeah.
So it defines a null line. And that is precisely, when you projectivize, that's precisely the Hopf vibration in each of the four cases.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Yes, okay. Yeah. Sorry, I was trying to search for comments, and I'm somehow supposed to look at here. I've seen Porsche. I don't get it. Security participants. I only have nothing appears at the bottom of my screen. But
may I ask one? This is maybe kind of a broad question, but
yeah.
So in regarding how this might connect to the other talks in the workshop, you I think in a number of the talks the 2x2 Hermitian Jordan algebra over the
non-division
algebras will appear and play a role in the talks connecting
the
standard
model. That's right. I mean, I'm sure that.
And there,
of course, yeah, that's right.
I was just going to ask.
And of course, the vast generalizations of that, and of course, the prior things of Kramer and Julia and so on. You know, all the E8 and so on. So I'm sure they will. That seems in a way much more likely for that to play a connection to the standard model.
Right. I was just going to ask, and related to that, I mean, somehow your story here involved the 2x2 case. Does the 3x3 case show up anywhere? I mean, I know that this doesn't have, as far as I'm aware, there's no simple corresponding spinner interpretation in that case.
Well, actually, Sierra was sort of trying to do that in his paper here. Because, and in fact, I think various people, Cedewall has also written a paper about this, where you can try to take the point of view that since 2x2 matrices, since Minkowski spaces, can be point in Minkowski spaces 2x2 Hermitian matrices, when you go up to higher dimensions, instead of going up to higher dimensions where the group is again the Lorentz group, you go up in a different way. You go up to 3x3 Hermitian matrices, and you get the corresponding automorphisms group, the other one, structure group of the Jordan algebra, as the analog of a Lorentz group. So I mean, in way it suggests that when you go up in dimensions, you go up in a very different way. You don't preserve a kind of some orthogonal group structure. It's a different way of going up in dimensions. Now, so I think that's an interesting idea, but you can try to say, well, and so he was trying to do that. Also, Cedewall has written a paper trying to do that. I've had some remarks on it somewhere, but I don't know exactly where it goes. I mean, or indeed how that would have something to do with, maybe that direction is, it's a very interesting direction, but I think it's fair to say that it hasn't really gone very far. I mean, also, of course, a lot of the motivation for a lot of this stuff comes from string theory. As I mentioned, it was after Green and Schwartz, cubic identity, that people started looking at these things again a little bit. So, and that's all in 10 dimensions with an SO, 10 and so on, also 11 dimensional supergravity. So you're abandoning all of that, it seems, when you go into this other direction. So it's a direction which perhaps should be explored more. It has been explored a little bit, but nothing concrete has come out, I think, which has encouraged anybody to say, yeah, this is it. So I think, yes, it's interesting that there are these, in fact, somehow that these, there are actually various connections with supersymmetry, the various connections of the division algebras and so on, and they go in different directions, and they're not obviously compatible, and maybe they're not compatible, and you have to choose. I mean, it's unfortunate. You'd like, if you're a believer in in it, you'd like it to only work in one way ultimately, but that's the way that it was the case that in field theory we used to have to choose a dimension. But now we know really you have to use them all at once, because it's really, M theory, you really have to do everything at once. So maybe there's another kind of bigger picture in which they all pair at once. I don't know. But it's true that there are other directions.
Okay, thanks.
There's another question in the chat. Can you explain what exactly is the cubic identity in the context of Jordan algebras?
Yes, I can explain it. It's basically, that's very simple. You take the cubic identity can be viewed, I mean, it's an identity with gamma matrices, but if you contract all the indices with just commuting spinners, you can simply view it as an identity cubic in commuting spinners. Now, the point is that if you take the 3x3 Jordan algebra, you can simply break it into, as we heard, in fact, last week, you can simply break it into a 2x2 block. One by one and one by two. Now the one by two, the off diagonal blocks are basically spinners. And the point is now, if you look at the Jordan identity for the 3x3 case, and you sort of break it up into this structure, then that identity implies various sub identities, and essentially it ends up applying an identity for the. So that your commuting spinner over the real complex quaternions octonions is now just the off diagonal element in in these 3x3 matrices. Now the Jordan identity involves, you know, three different elements. So it's going to give you something cubic in U.
So can I just continue on that? The J3O also has a characteristic equation, which is cubic and depends on the trace, the determinant, and this two form. Is this in any way related to the cubic identity you're talking about?
Well, it's to the Jordan identity, basically, although the way Sierra does it in his paper is not by writing down the Jordan identity, but it must be equivalent to that. I was at some point going to sit down, and when I was re-looking at his paper again, I thought, well, I should simply write down the Jordan identity and do it. I think it's been noticed probably later by other, well, in fact, Shreya, I mean, other people have done it. So my guess is it's already in the literature. That's how it must work, because it is a cubic identity in spinners. And the spinner in question is the off-diagonal component of this 3x3 emission matrices. And the emission matrices to be the Jordan identity is precisely, and of course it's an identity. So you'll just discover that it's an identity, right? So what happens is people just, when you're showing that the 3x3 octonionic matrices satisfies the Jordan identity, which obviously was done by presumably back in Jordan, von Neumann, and Wigner. The point is, if you do that calculation, but breaking the three-dimensional identities, three-dimensional matrices up into 2x2, you know, into those blocks, and actually following through the calculation, you'll discover that at some point you're using the cubic identity.
So if I wanted to find out the eigenvalues of this 3x3 matrix in the octonionic case, I would essentially be using the identity, or that's something different?
The eigenvalues. There is actually a paper precisely about eigenvalues of the 3x3 matrix by Dre and
Steven Dre and Manog have a paper.
I came across their paper recently looking through the things, but I haven't read it really.
You know, the reason I brought it up is if you make a octonionic representation for the standard model fermions using the three fermion generations in this matrix, and you try to find out eigenvalues, you're probably making an interesting contact with the fundamental dimensionless constants of the standard model. No one, like, suppose I want to look into mass ratios. I expect that since the three generations differ only in masses, I expect these eigenvalues to have something to possibly do with mass ratios. That's why I brought this up. Have you come? And this is very close to what Dre and Manog almost came to. I mean, they wrote down the eigenvalue equation, which is a cubic, but they didn't solve it. And as far as nobody's tried to solve it, but we know from already quite some work that if we use, say, the Clifford algebra CL6 complexified, we have a basis for the fermions of three generations. I just need to plug it in and find the eigenvalues. They are real, and I should be asking, what exactly do those eigenvalues mean?
Comment on the question.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, but the point, let's remember what I was saying before, is that this identity, I mean, literally is an identity. So actually you don't need to know it, right? I mean, if you do your calculation correctly, it will just be what it is. I mean, so in some sense, being an identity, I mean, it means that you don't need to know what it is. They just, you know, after all, we know that the 3x3 emission matrices do satisfy the Jordan identity. I think there's an octic invariant called the Glennie identity, which is not satisfied by the Jordan, by the 3x3. It's satisfied by emission matrices over reals of any rank over reals complex quaternions, but it's not satisfied by the 3x3 octonionic matrices. And that's the way that you show that that's the simplest way, I think, to show that it's an exceptional Jordan algebra. I mean, I think that the result goes back to Albert, or says it, sometimes it's called the exceptional Jordan algebra. But one way to show this is an exceptional Jordan algebra is to show that assuming associativity, you can prove an identity for 3x3 matrices over RCH. In fact, I think it's n by n identities, but in any case, it's the so-called Glennie identity, octic identity. And it's okay, the octonionic ones fail to satisfy that.
Okay, there's another question. Lee Smolin has a question.
Yeah.
Paul, it's nice to see you after a long time.
Ah, Lee. Hi, Lee. Yeah. Yes.
I really have a question which is in the way of advice. I had one effort to get involved in this kind of stuff about 20 years ago, where I wrote a paper on the matrix string using the exceptional Jordan algebra. And everything seemed to work beautifully, except that my fermions, of course, were bosonic.
Interesting that you make that point, because there is a paper by Del Burgo, and I've got a bunch of them here. Del Burgo, is it one by, I've been sort of collecting a little bit here, these things. It's by Del Burgo and
probably since.
And somebody, anyway. I think I don't have it because I think that you can't, I mean, it's in one of these journals that you have to go to the library and make a photocopy, you know?
Oh my God.
I think I do have a hard copy in Cambridge. They try to use the exceptional Jordan algebra to construct, a construction of the superstring. But that they, of course, they realize the point at some point they have to put anti-commuting variables into the off-diagonal elements.
And then they're no longer octonian. They no longer have the algebra of octonian.
But, I don't see that what they're doing really is Jordan algebra anymore. Maybe some kind of, I mean, also super Jordan algebras, but which I know actually not a lot about. But you would think if one is doing supersymmetry, one should look at super Jordan algebras too. I'm sure Murat Kanaydin has done that.
We talked to him anyway.
Yeah.
That seemed to be a fatal flaw, but I had some fun with it at the time.
I can only just hear you, Lee.
We didn't know what to do after that.
I'm afraid I can't offer a whole lot of advice.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe we reached the end of the questions.
Yeah.
Let's thank Paul again. It was a very interesting talk.
Sure.